Speaking of our little albino Mata Hari, what are we going to do about her?
Kill me now if you don't trust me. I leap at your throat with my teeth, if that make you feel like it was self-defense.
I'm not so sure trust is an option here. You have been spying on us.
Not spying! Helping! If I not along, that ambush would have chilled you all, sure. Wrong?
She got you there.
He turned back to the girl, whose attitude still spoke spiky defiance.
Speaking of chilling, why don't you take a chill pill, Snowflake? No one's gonna hurt you. If we decide we don't trust you, we'll leave you taped up out here with a pair of nail clippers and your pack just out of reach. You should be able to work your way free in an hour or three and get on with your life.
If?
What if Animal find me? Or Cold Hearts? You not men enough to chill me yourselves?
Sorry, darling. There's only so much we can do. We still got a job to do. You'll have to take your chances like everybody else in this cold, cruel, post-apocalyptic world. If that's what we decide to do with you. I'm working on a hunch.
Hayes rose.
Take a picture of this, gentlemen. She has done all she could to keep us and her other friends from wasting one another. Even if she has been a little rougher on their Indian pals and the MIBs.
Hate mags and anybody shooting at me.
Kind of figured that. I don't understand our little sweetie's game. None too certain she does herself altogether. But doing the dirty to us doesn't seem to play any part of it.
He looked sharply at Reichert, who was elaborately looking everywhere but at him after the last sentence.
Something?
What? No, nothing. Maybe a little shocky, that's all.
Hayes's little laser-blue eyes narrowed, tracked from Reichert to Domi.
Anyway, it looks to me like we could still use a native guide, and she might just help us steer clear of any more nasty surprises. Maybe her friends will be reluctant to fry our butts with an orbital death laser if she's with us.
What if they're trying to lure us in?
Reichert was careful not to look at Domi.
It's the way we're already going anyway.
Okay, maybe they're trying to lull us then.
For what?
Anybody pulling Domi's string has already passed up their best shot at taking us down. Although why they're working at cross purposes with their shooters on this, I can't begin to say.
Like that'd be a new and different experience for us, having our own brass playing against the interests of their guys down with their asses in the grass.
Maybe they want to interrogate us. And learn what? They were four dipsticks who decided to forsake the world we all knew, the only world we knew, and take an eyes-wide-shut flying jump into the future as hand-picked hitmen for a 200-year-dead plutocrat? They already know we're stupid, too. What is it Fluffy Butt here calls it?
Triple stoop. Why you keep on going?
I'd say she's got a good question there.
What else have we got to do? We've got a job. What other purpose do we have for even being alive?
You still going to try to take Cerberus?
Like the man says, it's a job. We all agreed to do it. Besides, if we don't, I'll spend the rest of my life expecting to see Gilgamesh Bates appear out of a burning bush and rank us out. That Harry Seldon routine of his creeps me out.
Robeson frowned abruptly.
Now what's on your alleged mind?
I don't know. There's something about Harry Seldon.
I worry about you. All right, everybody, recess is over. Time to go for a nice nature hike.
What about the young woman?
What's it to be, hun? You with us? Or do we truss you up and let you take your chances with the giant, flesh-eating mutant iguanas?
You crazy. But I go along. I crazy, too. And there's no such thing giant mutant iguanas.
I'm so disappointed.
Reichert stood and shouldered his pack.
We have won.
An angry patch of burned flesh glowed on one of Skydog's cheeks, already beginning to weep clear fluid. Kane guessed it had been incurred policing Titano of live white phosphorus pellets. The tall, muscular shaman ignored it.
At least we have a victory to show for our losses tonight, if not the one we were looking for. Great will be the weeping in the lodges of the people.
I'm sorry, Skydog. I had no idea things would turn out this way. None of it.
I believe you, Trickster Wolf. The Great Spirit works in mysterious ways. But now I think it best if you two leave. Dawn comes soon, and I doubt the warriors will look with much favor on any Wessicon face by its light.
He smiled, but it wasn't a pleasant expression.
Besides, I don't want the hospitality we show our new guests from Koboldville
to upset your delicate sensibilities. I know how squeamish you white men are.
No.
Kane avoided looking at Grant, who already knew the Lakota saw no distinction between blacks and whites, or pretended not to. That wasn't what griped him.
We'll be on our way, then. For what it's worth, Skydog. Thanks.
Already walking away through the murk of dawn, back down the little ridge to the camp set up around the MCP, the shaman waved. He didn't look back.
I don't like leaving magistrates to be tortured by these outlanders.
Kane was taking out his radio. He had connected more closely with the Lakota than his partner had, just as Grant had found far more in common with the latter-day samurai of Nuedo than Kane had.
We're not mags anymore.
We knew those men.
Yeah, and you know what they'd do to us if the situations were reversed. Not a lot nicer than what they'll get.
The voice that answered his call to Cerberus was unfamiliar.
Noyan here.
And female. He vaguely recognized the name as belonging to one of the new recruits.
Kane, where's Lakesh?
He is asleep, Kane.
He does that a lot. I wish we could.
He glanced at Grant.
He left instructions for when you called, sir.
Don't call me sir, Nguyen. It makes me feel old.
Yes, sir. Dr. Lakesh requested that you return to Cerberus as soon as you had resolved matters with Skydog's people.
I'm guessing that means once we finished mopping up the Cobaltville mags?
So it would appear, sir.
All right. Give us a few. You might as well go ahead and wake Lakesh up, Nguyen, since we're dragging him out of bed by his prominent ear when we get there.
He switched off before she could sir him again.
Okay, Grant, time to go.
We'd never catch those bastards anyway, the head start they got.
It occurred to Kane to question that. Most or all of their quarry were injured, and not trivially. How fast could they be, realistically? He decided to save his breath. Neither they, the Lakota Nation, nor the Cobaltville and Mandeville Magistrate Divisions had appreciably slowed the intruders thus far. He doubted anything short of chilling all four would do the trick. Which he and Grant would most assuredly arrange, as soon as Lakesh's spy sats picked up the strangers for them and showed them a nice ambush point. Kane felt his heart pick up the beat. As redoubtable as Skydog's warriors were, and as heavy a price as they had paid this night on behalf of Cerberus, they had mainly wound up getting in the way and preventing Kane and Grant from chilling the four renegades. Kane actively looked forward to the rematch. As he'd told his partner before, just 2-on-4. He and Grant would show them what outnumbered meant.
Let's go beg a couple of horses from Skydog before things get too far along in the victory celebration. We can at least make a futile gesture at chasing those sons of bitches.
Phoenix team climbed. Because of Major Mike's and Sean Reichert's injuries, the team made slow but steady progress. Most of the time, Domi, in her role of scout, ran up and around the slopes ahead of them like a mountain goat. Their intention was to go over the top of the peak inside which Cerberus was buried and drop down to the redoubt entrance from above. Domi could only conclude that Lakesh wanted to see if Team Phoenix could actually do it. More, she guessed he wanted to see how they did it. For their parts, the four oddly yet well-matched men of Team Phoenix seemed totally resolved and focused on their mission. They knew now their every move was observed by the people they were coming to capture or kill. Yet it seemed to make no difference to them. They pressed on. They absolutely intended to penetrate and capture the impregnable fortress, even against alerted opposition. And Lakesh intended, it would seem, to let them try. Domi had decided they were all crazy. A thunderstorm whirled in from the plains on the night following the ambush. A jagged yellow-white crack split the sky above Kane's and Grant's heads as they rode along on a pair of ponies Skydog had lent them. At least they had saddles. That was some consolation. Grant hated horses as it was. Although the official Lakota riding style was bareback, not all the warriors did so. Not just a matter of the often prickly individuality their culture promoted, but also the fact that not all the warriors were exactly Lakota or Cheyenne or even Amerindian by birth. Territorial expansion had compelled Skydog to do some recruiting. Not all his men had been raised on horseback, so there were saddles and saddle-broke horses available. As The crack of thunder pounded their eardrums. A cloudburst landed on them with furious force. It was as if a waterfall had materialized from air right over their heads. Kane glanced at Grant. In the dark and the deluge, it was difficult to see, but Kane got the impression his old partner was scowling even more ferociously than usual. They rode on, upward, blindly, hoping they were following the path taken by the openwork wag. Team Phoenix and Domi were scaling a smooth stone wall when the storm broke over them. Although Reichert was younger and, when uninjured, more agile, Robeson was far the group's best technical rock climber, having vastly greater experience. It was one of his passionate hobbies, a holdover from mountaineering training he'd received in his SEAL days. Actually, from a standing start, the best climber was Domi, who could swarm up all but the sheerest rock face like a live white monkey. But this was the sheerest rock face. So she stood perched on a jut of granite and stared upward, disbelieving as the rain slammed her in the face. Robeson was pounding in pitons with a small rock hammer and using them to clamber higher. He worked deliberately, with mechanical precision and the machine's untiring persistence. Even though he was secured by ropes looped through rings, sewn in harnesses worn by Hayes and Weaver, themselves dogged onto pitons driven deep in rock, it took inhuman courage, endurance, and determination to keep driving himself up that glass-slick rock. Domi had thought that people from before Skydark were soft, and aside from the devilishly handsome and lean Sean Riker, none of these men looked any too impressive. Maybe except for Weaver, who did look as if he had been carved out of rock, but he was old. Yet she now realized that the only force upon this earth that could stop them was death itself. Was she leading them to death? Or was death what she was leading to Cerberus? Whom was she betraying? She was beyond confused now, but at least Grant was all right, and Kane. The rain was as cold as death. Domi felt her face growing numb, along with her fingers, pressed to the rock face. She took first one hand and then the other away from the cold stone to flex the fingers and try to keep life and feeling alive in them. She didn't look down. She heard Robeson's voice in her skull.
I just had an idea.
Must be lonely.
Major Mike was near Domi with his boot soles braced against the cliff and his butt against an outcrop. A floppy Kevlar hat covered his half-haired head.
Oh, yeah.
Aside from a slight puffing of exertion, there was no sign he was engaged in a dangerous and demanding climb.
I finally figured out what was bugging me about the whole Harry Seldon thing.
You mean your pal Gilgamesh's shtick?
That's the one. You remember he talked about some kind of mutant imperator arising to attempt to reunify the disintegrating baronies?
That's affirmative.
Now, think about your original Foundation trilogy. At a certain point, all Seldon's miracle psycho-historical predictions ran right off the rails. Remember why?
Domi heard a scraping sound even over the rushing roar of the rain. She saw Robeson's leg swing free, deeper darkness against dark, as rock crumbled away from beneath his boots. For a moment, he hung suspended, only by a hand clinging to the piton he had just driven in. Domi's heart lodged in her throat. The arm that had been waving wildly moved with sudden purpose. The rock hammer, which had fallen to dangle from its lanyard, swung up to be seized again by the free hand. The bearded man was climbing barehanded so he could feel his grip. His fingers had to be as cold and stiff as hard rubber now. Domi marveled he could cling onto the piton, much less catch the hammer. He turned it in his grip and drove the pick end into a crack in the rock, invisible to the eyes watching from below. Then he swung up his leg, scrabbled his boots, found another purchase. Then, calmly, he pulled out another piton and began to drive it.
You okay, Slick?
Never better. You got an answer for me yet?
Foundation. Wasn't it the birth of that mutant with super mental powers? What was he called? The Mule. That was it.
Ding, ding. Show the man what he's won, Vanna. Now, what was that you said about the Mule?
Huh? He was a mutant. Holy shit.
You see the light, Grasshopper.
How could Gil know about this Imperator, no matter how good his prediction software was?
Short answer is, he couldn't.
Suddenly, Robeson's dark form disappeared from view.
Longer answer is, he still couldn't. Do the math.
Reichert was upright, leaning against the cliff, keeping watch with his suppressed MP5 in his one good hand, its long sling looped around his neck. Domi thought he was actually asleep. The climb had to be brutal for him. But now he roused and stood away from the rock.
You saying he's alive?
What do you think? I think he had his tricky ass frozen, too. I think we're being played for total fools.
Hayes shook his head like a slow-motion bulldog.
Not proved, Slick. Maybe Gil's little gnomes really could predict the Imperator's birth. Hell, maybe that wasn't an accident either. The way the war to end all wars apparently wasn't.
Believe whatever keeps you going, Chief. I got a ledge here. Let me secure a line and we'll bring all of you up and do it all over again.
Between their bizarre slang and utterly obscure references, Domi hadn't really been able to follow the conversation. But Robeson's conclusions came unmistakably clear. He looked wildly around at her companions, and Weaver and Hayes picked themselves up and stretched, trying not to be too obvious about it.
What's going on? What will you do now?
Bye, though. Fuck it and drive on, if you'll pardon my French.
But why? That red guy was lying to you. Larry just said.
Maybe. Maybe not. Not that it makes us any, never mind. Where the hell else are we gonna go?
It was somewhere past midnight, Domi judged. The rain had stopped. The overcast had shredded into big, irregular sheets of cloud with stars showing through. As usual, Joe Weaver played sentry. The others were gathered around the big, dark-bearded man as he worked a laptop in an extremely thin and shiny metal case. He sat on a rock in a little fold of the earth not far above the tree line.
Okay, here's where it gets really cool. Our briefing indicates this underground facility known as Cerberus Redoubt is surrounded by motion sensors. Well, common sense kind of dictates that too, right?
Realizing the question was directed at her, Domi nodded. She was unsure what to expect from these men now. They seemed driven by fatalism alone. They had their job to do. Maybe it was futile, maybe fraudulent. Yet they had to do it, if only to prove to themselves that they could. If only as a final act of defiance against a reality so monstrous that it had to inevitably crush them like worms. It was as if they were as eager to meet the test Lakesh was setting them as Lakesh himself was for them to pass it. But what would happen after that, she couldn't foresee. But she had a horrible feeling Lakesh couldn't either. Robeson talked as he typed.
The sensors are no doubt primarily passive. That means that unlike a spotlight, say, or a radar, they don't broadcast energy in order to detect objects by bouncing that energy off them. Which is what happens with a beam of light no less than a radar. They're like our eyes. They just wait for emissions from their targets to come to them. But that doesn't mean they don't emit any energy. They're electronic devices, just like that little satellite phone of Domi's. They give off a certain amount, even if only a very small bit, of radio frequency radiation just staying awake. And to report their results, by beam or broadcast or even by some kind of landline, that takes power too. All that produces radio noise. And that...
He pressed enter. The screen went black, then began to redraw itself in glowing yellow relief lines that Domi guessed represented the terrain surrounding them. A handful of blue dots appeared strewed across the map. Larry Robeson tapped a white cross in the map's center.
Here's our present position. The blue points are detectors that our own radio direction finding equipment has detected.
Sartorus Sartus. I love it when he talks dirty.
Robeson moved a cursor around the map with the pressure pad at the base of his keyboard.
Now we can, through the miracle of our own sensors, our database, and our employer's Wonder software, identify the nature of a certain number of these sensors.
He brought the cursor to a blue dot representing a sensor situated off to the right of their line of progress up the peak. Domi had no idea what the map scale was, so couldn't guess how far it might be from them. Maps weren't her strong suit anyway. Robeson clicked, and a small window opened. Not identified, it read.
Don't you hate it when that happens?
Major Mike sat on another rock with a cold cigar butt in his mouth. He was definitely showing the signs of exertion, but he was in visibly better shape than Sean Reichert, and neither man showed the slightest inclination to quit or even slacken the pace.
Not necessarily, Kemosabe. It's a datum.
Robeson clicked on another blue dot. It produced the assessment sonic sensor. The third was infrared. Each was accompanied by letters and numbers Domi couldn't begin to interpret.
What we need to do is look for sensors whose nature we can be pretty confident of. In particular, whose limitations we know. For example,
he had continued to click on point after point. Domi quickly lost track of what the little on-screen boxes reported for each. But clearly the big man didn't. Suddenly, he made all the dots disappear except two, in red, flanking a concentration of roughly parallel contour lines.
Here we see two IR sensors, mounted to either side of what looks suspiciously like a narrow little gully. Now, as every schoolboy and girl knows, infrared is pretty much a line-of-sight proposition, just like its cousin, visible light.
Great. We're snooping and pooping with Mr. Wizard.
Be grateful, lad, be grateful. What this suggests to us, which is of immediate use, is a path between the sensors, along which we ourselves cannot be sensed.
And so they went up the dark mountain. Sensors waited to detect them. They eluded them. Tripwires lay in silent wait to snag them and trigger flares or lethal traps. They discovered them, neutralized, or stepped gingerly over them. Hidden weapons waited to destroy them. They crept past them undetected. The sensors were sensed, the traps avoided, the impregnable defenses well and truly breached. At times, Domi wanted to scream that Lakesh was watching every move on his satellites, that he didn't need sensors, that if he wanted them dead, he could chill them right now. But she knew they wouldn't hear her, wouldn't care if they did. They felt as if they had sacrificed their world, the people they had known, indeed their lives, for a shot at carrying out this one mission, performing this epic task, like characters out of one of the ancient myths Bridget Baptiste had told her about, like Ulysses or Lancelot. Having made that sacrifice, paid that terrible price, they would carry out their quest, even in the face of betrayal and certain death. She could have frustrated them, of course, at almost any time. Accidents happened, even to men as good as these were. As resourceful and cunning and skillful as she was, however little credit she generally got for any of those things from her Cerberus friends, she might have stymied them and still have a chance of getting away alive, especially since they weren't even treating her with special wariness. But aside from the respect and affection she had come to feel for these men, the warrior's bond of dangers shared and survived together, she didn't know where her own duty lay. Lakesh had his ass in the crosshairs here, and her discarded lover had not told her to stop Team Phoenix. So she would go along as far as they themselves could, and not hinder their efforts until and unless Lakesh asked her to. It wasn't a good answer, just the only one she could find. And if in the end Lakesh lay cooling, with his eyes staring without seeing at the acoustic tile ceiling of his precious control center, maybe it was time he paid a penalty for outsmarting himself. It was still dark, though not for many more minutes, when they found themselves on the plateau, crouched before the forbidding entrance to Cerberus.
What now?
Something wonderful.
Robeson crouched and unlimbered his laptop as the others covered the entrance with their blasters.
That is, unless Gilgamesh has well and truly screwed us over.
Always the optimist, aren't you, Squid Boy?
You can't get in! No way! Can't blow down door! Can't tunnel inside!
No. But we can override their security. Like so. Open sesame.
Yellow light spilled forth from the mouth of the mountain. A figure stood outlined against it. A figure with significant curves and hair like liquid fire. As their eyes adjusted to the light, the four men made out the most beautiful woman any of them had ever seen. In 200 years, anyway. And for a while before. It didn't prevent them from locking their weapon sights on her, nor did it keep fingers from slipping onto triggers and taking up slack.
Welcome to Cerberus Redoubt, gentlemen. Domi. I'm Bridget Baptiste. I am unarmored and unarmed. I present to you a simple choice. You can shoot me down right here and now, or we can talk.
The sun came up over the Bitterroot Mountain so hard and bright it should have made a noise.
Crap. I need a break.
Climbing a steep outcrop, Kane twisted to look at his partner. Grant looked a little gray, and it wasn't just the dawn light. The two had driven themselves relentlessly without rest for two nights and the intervening day. For most of the hours spent waiting for the ambush, they had slept while the Lakota danced and sang and gambled at Arkahe. But that had hardly been the most restful of rest. Kane also felt the fatigue's crush.
It's always worse than you think it is.
He realized he had spoken aloud in response to his own thought, a perfect illustration of what he had just said. He jutted his chin upward.
A few more feet. There's a ledge where we can rest.
Grant nodded heavily. From above, there was a pop. Both men tensed at the curious sound. Grant's right hand was reaching upward for a fresh purchase. It rotated clockwise, and his sin-eater whined into it. After a moment, a familiar head, surrounded by a short nimbus of cloud-white hair, poked over the edge of the ledge 10 feet above them and regarded them with ruby eyes.
Quit goofing off and hop on up here!
Grant kept the sin-eater in hand and pointed at her a beat longer. She paid no attention. After a moment, he sighed and let the hand blaster retract into its forearm sheath. Domi's head slipped back out of sight. Grunting, muscles heavy with fatigue, the two men dragged themselves upward. Kane, the lighter of the two, if lesser in sheer upper body strength, made it first. He put a hand back down to aid his friend. Grant collapsed on the ledge and lay on his back a moment, his great chest rising and falling as he sucked down air. He exuded weariness.
Domi, what the hell game are you playing?
No game.
She pointed up the mountain to where the entrance to the redoubt was concealed.
Welcome home.
Inside the redoubt, they were greeted by Lakesh, Brigid, and 4 strangers wearing Cerberus redoubt jumpsuits. Except, they weren't strangers. Over the past 30-some hours of constant mental replaying of flashes of memory, their faces and forms had become all too familiar. Tiny servo motors moaned as sin-eaters snapped into Kane's and Grant's hands simultaneously. The 4 intruders sat on crates or stood impassive, watching with relaxed interest, as if observing a sporting event whose outcome they didn't much care about. They didn't flinch as the blasters came out and began to twitch to and fro to bear on first one and then another of them. Not even when laser dots leaped forth to brush their chests and faces.
My very good friends, please put up your weapons. There has been a most terrible misunderstanding.
As one, Kane and Grant swiveled toward him. The perforated muzzles of their blasters tracked right along with them. Lakesh faced them unflinching, not glancing down, as 2 designator dots melded into 1 pink circle in the center of his sternum, although he paled.
I'll say, a misunderstanding that killed 30 or 40 of Skydog's men and damn near chilled us. A misunderstanding you were right smack in the middle of, weren't you, Lakesh?
No. Much as I dislike to contradict you, Grant, my dear friend, the misunderstanding must be laid at the villainous feet of one Gilgamesh Bates.
Who?
Our employer.
Weaver sat on a crate of M-72 laws.
Our late employer. Or I guess I should say former.
Hayes was a sight, with half a head of hair and salve glistening on the angry red right side of his face. For a time that seemed to stretch toward infinity, they held that way. 2 men staring at 4, the 4 gazing back with an increasing air of defiance.
If you're going to kill us, go for it.
Reichert's upper torso was extensively bandaged and his right arm in a sling. The bandages were too clean and comprehensive to have been dragged clear across the bitter roots. Clearly, Reba DeFour had been at work. He had a drifty manner, as if on drugs. As badly hurt as his brush with Kane had left him, no doubt he was pumped to the eyelids with painkillers.
We've had enough suspense to last us for a while.
Why don't we all put up our toys and turn down our testosterone levels? Discuss things as if we were all reasoning beings. You boys can always kill each other later if it makes you feel better.
Damn it, Brigid. This is serious.
Yes, it is. Much too serious to let your masculine egos do the thinking for you.
Domi stepped in between the 2 groups of men and stood straight.
Want to chill them? Have to chill me, too.
I'm not so sure that's not a good idea.
Brigid stepped up beside the slim albino girl, dead into the line of fire.
You don't mean that, Grant.
She's right. We can always shoot it out. I'd like to find out what the hell's been going on myself.
Grant turned a terrible eye on him.
It can't end this way, Kane. There's been too much blood.
Yeah, way too much blood. For both of us. How many years ago?
He shook his head as if it were as heavy as an anvil.
Do you think it's easy for me to let go of it, Grant? That chilling heat? That frenzy that can only quench itself in blood? It's all so easy. Just a couple pounds pressure on the trigger, Every question answered. Easy.
Grant glared at him.
You're always flashing back on our mag days, Grant. And it's true, we were made to be magistrates. And the one thing we can never shake is the compulsive need to do our duty, no matter what it costs us. But we've taken on new duties, even if nobody can quite explain to us what they are. Right now, my sense of duty tells me that what I should do is listen, even if it means delaying the pleasure of flash-blasting these renegades.
Grant raised his eyebrows at his ferocity, which Kane had never intended. Kane felt the subtle shifting of weight by the four men as they prepared for action.
Okay, Kane, you win. If you can hold it in, I can too.
His Sin-Eater slammed back in its holster.
Because you're a lot crazier son of a bitch than I am.
To let a little more tension bleed out of the situation, Lakesh led the group to a private briefing session in the cafeteria rather than in the formal briefing area. They walked in three clumps, Kane and Grant to the right, Phoenix team to the left, with Domi and Bridget between them, like control rods between slugs of uranium. In the cafeteria, Bridget performed introductions in a businesslike manner. The ploy had worked. Everyone was calmer now, as much perhaps because of the fatigue bearing down upon all six warriors as for any other reason. Keeping an edge of killing rage just took too damn much effort. Major Michael Hayes stepped up to Kane. For a moment, the two men stood, sizing each other up. Then Hayes stuck out his hand. Without a word, Kane took it and shook it. Grant scowled so hard his face became just one big dark cloud of dismay. He was having doubts again.
Is this right, Kane? Not 2 days ago, we were doing our level best to chill these guys.
Well, let me be the first to thank you for not succeeding.
The heavily bandaged young man introduced as Sean Reichert offered his left hand to Grant.
Mr. Grant, I have to tell you, it was a real honor almost being wasted by somebody who looks just like Fred Williamson.
Who's Fred Williamson?
20th century professional football player turned actor.
Fred Williamson was the man.
I was the one who almost wasted you.
And now that we are all friends together...
Lakesh spoke from the head of the table, displaying a level of sanguinity that was manic even for him.
Let us all take seats around the table. There awaits much to be revealed.
They took seats, Kane and Grant to Lakesh's right, the other four men down the other side of the long, truncated oval table. Bridget stood by Lakesh. Domi sat at the far end, still between the two groups of men. Grant's eyes kept darting to her under lowered, heavy brows.
Gentlemen, the first thing I must tell you is that if you owe a blood debt, and I agree that you do, it isn't on one another's hands. You have been used.
By Lakesh and Domi. And you too, Bridget?
Bridget drew herself up as if prepared to abandon her own role as peacemaker and flare out at him.
My friends, we have all been forced into actions that are very much now to be regretted because of the machinations of one supremely evil man, Gilgamesh Bates.
In the darkened room, Bridget summed up her recapitulation of the research she'd related to Lakesh earlier.
Bates is a brilliant man, a very rich man, and a totally unscrupulous man.
The image of the man himself burned on the wall screen behind her. His deep-set eyes seemed to burn with unguessable depths of purpose and malice.
He is obsessed with both eternal life and power, which to my mind at least are really but two aspects of the same obsession. The fevered need not just to have control, but to maintain it forever.
The ultimate insecurity.
That is most astute, friend Larry.
Lakesh leaned forward in his chair as the lights came up. He was more than willing to sit and yield center stage to Bridget as long as she was doing all the work.
I must also say that both dearest Bridget's insights and yours accord most perfectly with the impressions I myself formed of Mr. Bates in person, back in the days before I went into cryosleep. Before we both did, it appears.
As nearly as we can reconstruct the course of events, based on my searches of existing archives, Lakesh's computer counter-intrusion measures, and what we have learned from the men of Team Phoenix, Gilgamesh Bates did, as he told the members of the team, survive the nuke cost and remain awake for a period of around 5 years thereafter. However, he told the team in what purported to be the broadcast of a briefing recorded 2 centuries ago, that he suffered at that time from an incurable disease that would soon take his life, We now know that was not true.
Indeed. He made similar claims to his associates before the nuke cost. Evidently, he was preparing his cover story well in advance.
Kane sprawled a little deeper in his chair.
I'm having a little problem following this, Baptiste. Bates's hologram appeared to these guys claiming to be dead, but he was actually alive?
Was and is. That is correct. He claimed to these men, whom he had recruited and trained especially for the mission of being frozen and then revived to aid in the rebuilding of America, that his software had such prodigious predictive capabilities that it could foresee events 2 centuries into the future to a startling degree of accuracy.
And they went for it?
That got him some hard looks from Reichert and Hayes, which Grant returned with interest.
It's not as if we were happy about it. We're all believers in free will over predestination, but Bates is a pretty persuasive kind of guy.
Mr. Bates has always been supremely persuasive, Grant, my honored associate. You would have to experience his gifts yourself in order to fully appreciate how powerful they are.
There's something I don't quite get here. If these boys were picked, trained, and frozen to rebuild America, how come they homed on Cerberus Redoubt like a heat-seeking missile, ready to chill anything in their path? Including, I gather, any occupants of Cerberus who happened to stand in their way.
Bates told us that Dr. Lakesh was preparing to use control of the Mattrans network to seize control of North America, as the Baronies continued to lose their grip and fall into internecine squabbling.
Hayes was clearly the man in charge, but the bearded man seemed to mostly serve as spokesman.
Hell! Is there anything this bastard Bates doesn't know about us?
Fortunately, yes. Lakesh?
Lakesh was beaming.
Most wonderfully succinctly put, dearest Bridget. Yes, gentlemen, ladies, Mr. Bates had every confidence in his abilities to take control of Cerberus. His attack was two-pronged. We have learned from the analysis performed under Bridget's splendid direction that he engaged initially in several months of reconnaissance in the form of ever-increasing intrusions into our computer systems. He was able to glean quite a bit of information directly from Cerberus Redoubt's own databases.
How could he do that?
Who wants to bet he wrote the damn software in the first place?
Precisely correct, Major. Bates's UR systems wrote software for a very great many government institutions and operations. And into all of them, he incorporated plentiful backdoors and Trojans to enable him to tap into them and ideally seize control.
And I thought Trojans were supposed to prevent infection.
Put a sock in it, and if you say on it, I'll break your other clavicle myself.
Tyrant?
However, we were not so ingenuous here at Cerberus as Mr. Bates assumed. I may fairly say I was not so ingenuous. I built safeguards of my own into the software, both before I myself was frozen and in the decades after my resurrection. Bates was able to gain access to our computers, but not control over them. He failed in his attempts to grant himself system administrator's privileges. In time, with the help of Donald Bry and some of our newer associates, I was able to shut him out of Cerberus altogether.
You sure about that?
Most certainly. Oh, we still allow him access to certain areas where he can learn or obtain nothing which can do us harm, so that he will not realize he has been found out. But he is contained. Partial proof of that fact appears to be the very fact he activated Team Phoenix and ordered them to seize Cerberus by force.
But how do you know he's still alive, and these intrusions aren't being carried out by some kind of artificial intelligence or software robot he programmed long ago to carry out his will even after he'd been dead for 200 years?
Our friends realized he must still be alive as they were scaling the eastern side of the peak beneath which we're sitting. Once they conveyed their suspicions to Lakesh, he reassessed the character of the intrusion attempts and decided it was unlikely they had been undertaken by a software robot, however sophisticated. There was a keen human mind, and even keener human will, driving the efforts to seize control of our systems.
Plus, it's just exactly the kind of sneaky rat bastard stunt Bates would pull.
You mean you knew this Bates was a fraud? But you drove on to Cerberus anyway, knowing the people here were waiting to chill you when you tried?
He shook his head with something like admiration.
And I thought Kane and I were crazy.
I guess you gentlemen aren't the only ones with a sense of duty that borders on the ridiculous.
Somebody's got to be the sucker, so it might as well be me. What does Bates want so badly with Cerberus?
We surmise that he has some larger scheme in mind than controlling the redoubt for its own sake. Obviously, he wants control of the Mattrans network, presumably to dominate North America and supplant the baronies himself.
That does sound like the Gilgamesh we know.
I worked out that much for myself. But we don't control the baronies simply because we've got our fingers on the pulse of the gateway net.
Manifestly, he must have more resources on hand to exploit possession of the gateways than a mere 4 men, no matter what kind of super soldiers they happen to be.
Reichard flashed his devil's grin beneath his mustache.
Thank you kindly, ma'am.
It's an assessment I believe Mr. Kane and Mr. Grant would concur in.
It'd make us look like total dregs to deny it.
So you think Bates has more up his sleeve than just us?
The question is, what?
I was hoping you could give us some clues here.
Dr. Baptiste...
Just Bridget. I'm no doctor.
You're starting to sound like DeFore.
Bridget, it looks, pretty frankly, as if you know more about our erstwhile employer than we do. A lot more.
But Commander Robison, my new friend, you have personal experience of the man. Even though I indeed knew him personally, a lifetime, many lifetimes ago, you have spent far more time with him and seen much more of him.
And he fleeced us like a flock of little lambs.
He's a revolving son of a bitch, if you'll pardon my French, ladies. Meaning, any way you look at him, he's still a son of a bitch.
And he's a raving megalomaniac.
So if you expect the worst from him, that's what you're likely to get.
You guys are way too much like quadruplets.
Go figure. That's why Gil picked us out to attack the future single or quadruple-handed. Or his experts did. One thing about Gil, he knows the best and ignores the rest.
The bottom line is that we doubt we can add anything usable to what you've managed to find out on your own, which is mainly that he wants Cerberus and wants it badly.
Hayes turned to Lakesh.
But we still don't know what for. Unless you manage to turn some of his tricks back on him.
Sadly, no. How about tracing his intrusion attempts back to his physical location?
Lakesh looked to Bridget, then back to Kane.
After initial optimism, we failed in all our attempts to do so. Bates is a most diabolically clever individual. But we shall certainly continue our efforts. And eventually, he will make some mistake and we shall have him.
But for now, he holds all the cards.
There are 4 he doesn't hold any longer anyway.
Or whatever that may be worth.
Talk of the current situation continued among Kane, Grant, Bridget, and Phoenix team over lunch in the commissary.
Listen to what you're telling us. There's 45,000 people max in the Ninevilles themselves. That's by the Baron's own rules. They have maybe, big maybe, a couple of thousand more scattered in facilities like the ones you've disrupted, which are still secret. They've got an unknown number of indigenous assets like those militia we ran into in Ozone Hole.
As he paused to take a drink of apple juice, Kane and Grant traded looks. Ran over would have been a better term for what they did to the Mandeville Mercies.
Now, even if they've got the poor bastards out in the weeds so thoroughly ground down they won't even dream of disobedience... And granted, we've seen some of that firsthand. They still have way too much territory to hang on to.
Look at it from another angle. How well does Cobaltville control Skydog and his band of merry pranksters? And on our way to running into them, we bypass the Ebsaraki, whom everybody tells us won't take anything off either the Lakota or the Mags. Just the little bit you yourselves have told us indicates you've run up against plenty of resistance to the bad guys out there. Even if it is just refusal to cooperate with authority hiding behind feigned submission, which is usually the most dangerous form of subversion in the long run.
Sean Reichard had his left arm on the table and leaned forward, resting his chin on it, while Domi sat beside him, playing with his short, thick hair.
All respect, but having this nice, invincible and invisible hole in the ground to run back to has given you a case of the fortress mentality.
I don't need some snot-nosed punk telling me about my mentality.
Grant resentfully sat up in his chair, ignoring the fact the punk in question had a good 2 centuries and change on him. Even Kane, who didn't consider himself exactly thin-skinned where criticism was concerned, was about ready to go off.
Hearts and minds, Sean.
Reichard sat up and raised a placatory palm.
Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying you guys haven't been out there kicking butt and taking names, and in general, hanging your own asses well over the line. It's just that, well, listening to you talk, there's almost a kind of fatalism to it. As if you feel these hybrids and the humans who work with them have already won, and that humanity's been yanked from the game and is headed for the showers for good.
Despite missing completely the young man's closing reference, Kane felt his words like a dash of water in the face. That was how Kane had felt for years since beginning to learn the truth. Although he and his comrades had discovered that humanity's self-proclaimed leaders were far more vulnerable than they first appeared, Kane and company had even reshaped the future in defiance of them, he still found himself unable to shake the marrow-level conviction of futility.
"Which makes your keeping up the fight all the more heroic. But we don't share your conviction about the odds."
Now, as farewells were being said, Kane was still gripped by the suspicion the four might have a point. Have we given the bastards too much power just by assuming they had it? With the exception of Lakesh, all of them had grown up in the shadow of that power. Even outlanders like Domi felt the power of the Baronies as a constant menace, dangerous in part because of the Baron's unpredictability. It was unknown when and for precisely what reason they might decide to reach out their mailed fists and smite the Outlands. Kane and Grant, of course, had once been those very fists. For their part, Lakesh, Kane, and even Brigid, in a rare alliance, maintained that the men of Team Phoenix were simply too few to make an impression. The Outlands were vast and would swallow them and their best efforts without a trace, even presuming the magistrates didn't track them down and flash blast them. They underestimated the sheer magnitude of what they were pitting themselves against. In very different ways, each of the four Freezy commandos had manifested precisely the same response to those arguments, an irritating cockiness, an unassailable confidence that in a contest between them and the world, they had the world surrounded.
"Are you certain you will not stay with us, my friends? We could be of very great assistance to one another in pursuing our common ends."
The four men of Team Phoenix stood adjacent to the armaglass jump chamber. They were kitted out as they had come into Cerberus, down to Major Mike's scorched BDU shirt. Everything had been cleaned, and they had made a few repairs. But aside from the water in their canteens, they had refused all offer of additional supplies except for satellite-capable radios they could use to contact Cerberus.
"Yeah, we're sure. But thanks, Dr. Lakesh. We just feel we're best suited doing what we were recruited to do in the first place."
"One common end we'll be happy to help you pursue any time, though, is Gilgamesh Bates. You find out where he is, all you have to do is whistle."
Lakesh opened his mouth to say more, presumably yet more last-minute sales pitch.
"Give it up, Lakesh. These boys are just too smart to stay under your thumb. If only we were."
"You haven't gone yet!"
"You are tardy, marvelous girl. Really, that was most thoughtless."
"She missed your farewell speech. That makes her smart, not thoughtless."
Major Mike Hayes took out the fresh, unlit cigar he had put in his mouth.
"You know, we wouldn't leave without saying goodbye to you, sweetie."
She flew up to him, gave him a big hug and a tearful kiss. She repeated the performance with the others. The albino girl, dressed in her trademark super short shorts and a ribbon of tank top out of deference to Brigid, lingered extra long over her farewell to young Reichert. Then she stepped back, sniffling and wiping her nose with the back of her hand.
"She'll miss you most of all, Scarecrow."
Hayes elbowed Reichert, who pretended not to notice. Grant finally showed some sign of animation. He rolled his eyes at Kane, who grinned.
"You can take a girl out of the Outlands."
Hayes held up a thumb.
"We're cleared for takeoff, Captain."
They snapped to attention, saluted briskly, palms down, then prepared to enter the jump chamber.
"You know, I really have to give the nod to Luc Besson, even over John Woo."
"What? You cannot possibly be serious."
As the jump chamber door closed, Domi burst into tears.
"They all fused in the head."
"They're not the only ones."
"I don't know. I could kind of get to like those guys. Got to admire their style."
Kane pulled something from his pocket.
"You would. Of all the people we've met, we finally come across ones who are better at pissing people off than you are, Kane."
"Oh, I don't know why I'd say they were better."
Kane began to unwrap the cigar he had drawn from his pocket.
I will say that anything the Baronies have to worry about other than tracking us down is fine by me. Not even going to war with each other has gotten their minds off us. Maybe Team Phoenix can do it.
The four men were bound for the vicinity of the former Cape Girardeau in Missouri, near the confluence not just of the great Mississippi and Ohio rivers, but a full three baronies, Mandeville, Palladiumville, and Beausoleilville. Despite the relative proximity of Beausoleilville proper in what had been western Tennessee, it was bound to be a problematic zone for the barons to control. Administrative boundaries always are, and the increasingly open conflict among the baronies would ripen it even further for Team Phoenix's special brand of subversion.
After all, they really do have a talent for pissing people off. But hey, they left us these great cigars.
You're not going to light those here.
Yep.
That's the first good idea you've had since we got back, Kane.
Grant took out one of his own stogies.
And you know something? Anybody who shares cigars this good can't be all bad.
Admit it, Gilgamesh. Your men have betrayed you. Humans always do.
The auburn-haired woman who stood on one side of Gilgamesh Bates's bed of command was of medium height, slinky and lean, with narrow features, piercing blue eyes, and blue-white pale skin. Her hair was cropped to a short, careless brush. She was strikingly beautiful, but something in her very posture made clear she was unaware of the fact. She was answered by the giant who stood on the other side of Bates's bed.
That, or they have been overpowered or destroyed. It's certain that they respond to no communications attempts, nor have they called in as they were instructed to do when they seized control of Redoubt Bravo.
The waterbed sloshed slightly beneath Bates's long weight, reflective of the small involuntary body motions entailed in his trying to keep control before his underlings as he sat propped up by specially shaped pillows. Usually it wouldn't matter to him. A man who understood both the nature and perquisites of power, he would have screamed and wept and raged and ranted and torn things up to his heart's content until the vast fury seething inside him had at least dwindled to manageable levels. Then he would have had any servants unfortunate enough to have witnessed his outburst disposed of. Unfortunately, these were two among his minions who were not so readily expendable. His master chamber was spacious, large enough to provide ample living area, as well as to host small conferences among key privileged personnel. The walls were draped in red cloth or concealed behind red panels, except for the curving wall past the foot of the immense bed that served Gilgamesh Bates as throne, resting place, and recreation center. This was a giant screen upon which Gilgamesh Bates could display all the information in the world, or nearly so, in response to keyboard, handheld remote, or even his own voice, whichever way whim took him. Right now, it was blank. He couldn't bear to witness any further confirmation of the failure of his scheme.
Enkidu, my strong right arm, I fear your own noble heart steers you astray. Cerberus Redoubt lay helpless before my men. If they failed to take it, it was because they chose not to. Chose to defy my will.
He had to break off then, while his hands knotted like spastic spiders in the maroon silken coverlet. The giant turned away. At first glance, he appeared nothing more than a marvelously well-muscled man of normal size. It was only when there was something to compare his stature to that the truth became apparent. He was fully 8.5 feet tall, with skin something of the color of fired clay tile, a broad jaw, and a wild mane of black hair. No giant, technically, he was something rare still, a huge but fully healthy human being, whose extra-heavy bones and joints and an unusually powerful heart, supported by extraordinary muscular development and tone, protected him from the rapid internal degeneration, mechanical if nothing else, that usually killed humans of such size at an early age. He had been a professional assassin when Bates had enticed him into his employ. That possibly the most conspicuous man on Earth could succeed in a craft in which utter inconspicuousness was sine qua non testified to a fact that Bates had confirmed by tests but never acknowledged. The man he called Enkidu had a genius-level intelligence, although he himself had no inkling of the fact, and indeed was pathetically ill-educated when Bates found him. He had not, needless to say, been named Enkidu at birth. Ironically, the woman, who stood to the left of Gilgamesh's mighty boat of a bed, had been named Ishtar by her parents. She was, as her accent made clear, British by birth. She had been among the world's leading biochemists, a master of the most arcane variety of genetic engineering, which made it even more ironic that he had plucked her from a British prison where she was awaiting trial for protesting against genetic engineering and animal testing and under intense investigation on suspicion of planning wide-scale bioterrorism, which, of course, she was guilty of. Her objections to bioengineering and even animal experimentation were vehemently evoked when she wasn't the one doing them. She had a Byzantine scientific and ethical argument elaborated to justify the apparent inconsistency. She was even more brilliant than Bates's monstrous head of security, and in her own way, even more elemental. She desired, simply, to become the angel of death and rid the suffering earth of the human cancer that had afflicted it for millennia. Now Bates turned his deep-set maroon eyes upon her. She was as easy to handle as warm nitroglycerin, and had the pleasant temperament of a wolverine with hemorrhoids. But she held the key to power almost unimaginable by Gilgamesh Bates, whose imagination was capacious indeed when it came to such things. Also, she was great in bed. It was Gilgamesh Bates's great conceit that, having been an ill-socialized nerd, and it took a lot of raw native ability to be ostracized for that at Los Alamos High School in the 1960s, he had become first and foremost a master of manipulating people. His computer wizardry was mere adjunct to his real art, which made the sting of Team Phoenix's apparent defection, or even failure, more poignant still. To his right stood a man who could literally tear Gilgamesh Bates to pieces with his bare hands. To Bates's left, a woman who could destroy him with custom-grown beasts ranging in size from microscopic self-replicating assemblers to that of a bull African elephant. It tickled his vanity to keep such immediately lethal menaces close beside his person. It was sheer bravura. And now it was time to take a step even he had been reluctant to take, to initiate the process by which he was now compelled to claim dominion over Earth, and then get his chief lieutenants out of the room so he could pitch the good old-fashioned tantrum he so desperately needed.
Ishtar, the time has come.
You've realized you can rely on my dear animals, unlike humans.
Just so. I bow to your wisdom, fair Ishtar. We will do it your way now.
Ever perverse, she hung back.
It will take time.
Bates audibly ground his teeth with the effort of containing himself.
Then take time. Now go!
Outlander's Awakening is a Graphic Audio production. Outlanders and all characters are trademarks owned by Harlequin Enterprises Limited, used by others under license. Copyright 2003, Worldwide Library, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2005, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Performed by Terence Aselford, Nanette Savard, Thomas Penny, Richard Rowan, Jeff Baker, Christopher Graybill, and Mort Shelby. Additional red shirts by The Dead Giveaways. Directed by Terence Aselford. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing by Nathaniel Perry and Brian Rogers. Graphic audio sound design by Chris Rowan and Brian Rogers. The Outlander's theme was composed by Norman Vandersleis. Additional original music by Chris Rowan. If you enjoyed Outlanders, be sure to look for James Axler's Deathlands, available at road stops everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloadable extras, forums, and podcasts. Keep listening for a preview of another Graphic Audio title.
The following preview is of a Graphic Audio production rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Stony Man number 75, Silent Arsenal. Myanmar. For years, a nation devastated by war, by disease, by total despair. A dying country. And things are about to get even worse.
An experimental bioweapon has crash-landed on that hillside, releasing a contagious payload. Our sources say it has a 100% fatality rate.
Our people are dying! I must help! I have to do something!
There's nothing you can do! They're already dead!
An anonymous informant has proof that Myanmar was not an accident, but a test.
The organization claims to have stockpiles of the disease and a delivery system that's twice as effective as the one used on Myanmar.
What are their demands?
Does it matter?
Of course it doesn't. I just want to know exactly what we're looking at here.
Al, we're looking at the end of the world.
Now, with the planet held hostage, only one force stands in the way of complete destruction.
Vacation's over, boys. Time to get back to work.
The Soldiers of Stony Man.
Kill them! Kill them all!
They're tearing through our defenses! I've never seen anything like it!
Fool! Can't you do anything?
Surprise! You're all dead.
Stony Man 75, Silent Arsenal, in graphic audio, a movie in your mind.
The following preview is of a graphic audio production rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Destroyer 95, High Priestess. From the producers of Deathlands, Outlanders, Stony Man, and The Executioner comes a gripping, wild, and hilarious new series. It's in graphic audio. It's a movie in your mind. It's The Destroyer. Korea, home of the mysterious Order of Shinanju, ancient training ground for the world's most deadly assassins. Here, Chun, the master of Shinanju, passes his lethal skills on to the first White Eyes ever to be so honored, Remo Williams, soon to be known as the Destroyer.
You're trying to kill me, aren't you?
Yes. Your enemies will attempt to kill you in earnest. If I am to instill in you the reflexes that will save your life, I must do the same.
Tibet, mountain stronghold. Ancestral source of Tibetan Buddhism. For decades, the peaceful inhabitants have been under the heel of the ruthless Red Chinese.
Oh, most holy. The Panchen Lama is dead.
There is only the Bunchi Lama left. We must seek him out, or Tibet shall forevermore be a vassal of China.
But where lives the Bunchi Lama's reincarnation? Who possesses the wisdom to divine his whereabouts?
Behold! The sign that has appeared on the shoulder of every Bunchi Lama down through the ages.
Oh my God! It's a birthmark I never noticed before!
That's your vaccination mark, you dip.
I'm the Bunchi Lamb! This is better than winning at Wheel of Fortune!
Squirrely Chicane, film star and mystic, is about to play the biggest role of her award-winning career. Her co-stars are Mongols, monks, the unwashed Tibetan masses, and the whole Chinese army.
Holy crap. Look at all those tanks.
At last. A test worthy of our skills.
Couldn't we find a smaller army to test our skills?
Can Remo and Chun keep this drama from fading to black before the final credits roll? Destroyer 95, High Priestess.
The following preview is of a graphic audio production rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Outlanders 28, Mad God's Wrath. The Cerberus team thought he was dead, but his followers never gave up.
What? What are you doing?
Fulfilling the destiny of my god. McCann, once again, I pledge myself to your service.
McCann, the prince of the alien Twaha Dedanan, has returned, armed with an ancient and awesome power. While Kane, Grant, and Bridget are distracted by another mission, McCann has hatched a plot that will bring the fight to their very doorstep. Cerberus Redoubt is under attack.
Armed security detail operations. Stand! Ah!
Who are you people? What do you want?
My followers and I have nothing to lose. Therefore, everything to fight for. Give me what I want, or prepare to wade in blood.
Now the Outlanders of Cerberus will have to travel farther than ever before to save their colleague, and perhaps the world itself.
Ah, dear friends, welcome to my home. I call it Lamu. You call it Mars.
Outlanders 28, Mad God's Wrath. In graphic audio, a movie in your mind.
If you can't find that hot graphic audio title you're looking for, just head to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD or MP3 disc format. Or, the fastest and cheapest way, download that puppy and play it on any of the many devices that'll play Windows Media. And if you're on the road or just a total computer feeb, snatch up the phone and call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220. Or www.graphicaudio.net.